Who is the heir of divine things? In the treatise before this one, we went through the subject of rewards as precisely as we could. Now our task is to inquire who the heir of divine things is. For when the wise man heard the oracle proclaim to him, "Your reward will be very great," he asks, saying, "Master, what will you give me? I am departing childless. This son of Masek, my houseborn slave, is Damascus Eliezer, and since you have given me no offspring, my houseborn slave will be my heir." Genesis 15, 1-3. Now who would not have been struck dumb and speechless at the majesty and greatness of the one uttering the oracle, if not from fear, then at least from overwhelming joy? For excessive griefs silence the mouth, and so too do excessive joys. That is why Moses too confesses that he became slow of speech and heavy of tongue from the moment God began to converse with him, Exodus 4:10. And the prophet's testimony is truthful, for it is likely that at that time the organ of the voice was held in check, while the reasoning that follows the course of thought, unrestrained in its rush, was philosophizing in an unbroken succession of beauties, of thoughts, not of words, with a swift and lofty power. But wonderful too are courage and outspokenness exercised, when it is fitting, toward one's betters, so that even the comic line seems to be spoken more truly than comically. If the slave learns to keep silent about everything, he will turn out wicked. Give him a share of frank speech. When then does a household servant properly exercise frank speech toward his master? Is it not when he is conscious of no wrong done by himself, and does and says everything on behalf of the one who owns him? When then is it fitting for even God's servant to speak freely before the one who is ruler and master, both of himself and of the universe? Except when he is pure of transgressions and judges from his own conscience that he is devoted to his master, enjoying greater joy at having become a servant of God than if he had reigned over the whole human race, having fastened upon himself, without a struggle, mastery over both land and sea. The devoted services and ministrations of Abraham toward his master are set forth by the closing words of the oracle delivered to his son. "I will give to you and to your seed all this land, and in your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed, because Abraham your father obeyed my voice, and kept my precepts and my commandments and my ordinances and my statutes." Genesis 26, 3-5. It is the greatest praise to neglect nothing that one's master commands, but to strive tirelessly and diligently, with a favorable disposition, to accomplish everything beyond one's power. There are, then, those for whom it is fitting to listen rather than to speak, those of whom it is said, "Be silent," and Deuteronomy 27:9, an altogether excellent precept. For ignorance is most bold and most talkative, and its first remedy is quiet, and its second is attention to those things worth hearing that are put forward. Yet let no one suppose that this alone is signified by "be silent and listen," but something else, more powerful still. For it counsels not merely to be silent with the tongue and to listen with the ears, but for the soul as well to undergo both of these. For many who have come to hear, someone have not come with their minds present, but wander outside and go through countless matters about countless things with themselves. Family affairs, foreign affairs, private affairs, public affairs, of which it would have been fitting not to be mindful at the present time, numbering through virtually everything in succession, and because of the great din within themselves, they are unable to listen to the speaker. For he speaks as though not to living beings, but to lifeless statues, which have ears but no hearing within them. If then, the mind deigns to consort with none of the things that visit it from outside or are stored up within, but achieving calm and stillness stretches itself out toward the speaker, having fallen silent in accordance with the precept of Moses, it will be able to listen with the whole of its attention. Otherwise, it will not have the strength to do so. For the ignorant, then, quiet is advantageous, but for those who reach after knowledge and are at the same time devoted to their master, frank speech is a most necessary possession. It is said, at any rate, in the Exodus, "The Lord will fight for you, and you shall be silent," and immediately following this, an oracle is set down. "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry out to me?'" Exodus 14, 14-15. As though those who have nothing worth hearing to say ought to be silent, while those who have entrusted themselves to a divine love of wisdom ought to speak, and not merely speak with quietness, but cry aloud with a still greater shout, not with mouth and tongue, by which speech makes the air take a spherical shape perceptible to hearing, but with the all-musical and most loud-voiced instrument of the soul, of which no mortal at all is a hearer, but only the one who is unborn and imperishable. For only a mind capable of intelligible things can grasp the well-tuned and harmonious melody of intelligible harmony, and not one of those confused among things of sense perception can do so. When the whole instrument of the understanding sounds forth in concord through the octave or the double octave, the hearer, as it were, inquires, though in truth not inquiring, for all things are known to God, why do you cry out to me? Is it in supplication to avert something, or in thanksgiving for a share in good things, or both together? The one who seemed slow of speech and heavy of tongue, and without reason is found to be so talkative that in one place he is represented not merely speaking but crying out, while elsewhere he uses an unceasing and unbroken torrent of words. For it says, Moses was speaking, and God was answering him with a voice. Exodus 19:19. He did not speak to completion, but kept speaking in an extended, drawn-out manner, and God did not teach to completion, but answered continuously and without pause. And wherever there is an answer, there is, in every case, a question. Now each person asks what he does not know, judging it worthwhile to learn, and knowing that the most beneficial task for the attainment of knowledge is to seek, to ask, to inquire, to suppose that one knows nothing, and to think that one has grasped nothing firmly. The wise, then, employ God as their guide and teacher, while those less complete employ the wise man. That is why they say, You speak to us, and do not let God speak to us, lest we die. Exodus 20:19. But the man of true worth uses such frank speech that he not only speaks and cries out, but even now cries out against, taking courage from genuine faith and from a sincere passion. For the words, If you will forgive them their sin, forgive it. But if not, blot me out of your book which you have written. Exodus 32:32, And did I conceive all this people, or did I give birth to them, that you say to me, Take them into your bosom as a nurse carries a suckling child? Numbers 11:12, And from where am I to get meat to give to all this people, since they weep before me? Shall sheep and cattle be slaughtered, or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together, and will that be enough? Numbers 11:13-22, And Lord, why have you afflicted this people? And why have you sent me? And from the time I went before Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has afflicted the people, and you have not delivered your people. Exodus 5:22-23, These words and others like them, one would have feared to speak even to one of the particular kings of this world. But he took courage to declare them even to God. This, then, was the culmination not simply of daring, but of a noble courage in him, because all the wise are friends of God, and above all according to the most sacred lawgiver. And frank speech is akin to friendship, since toward whom would one speak freely if not toward one's own friend? Most beautifully, then, in the oracles Moses is celebrated as a friend, Exodus 33:11, so that whatever bold and hazardous things he goes through may be seen to proceed from friendship rather than from self-will. For boldness belongs to the self-willed man, but courage is proper to friend. But observe again that his boldness is tempered with reverence. For the words, What will you give me? Genesis 15:2, show boldness, while master shows reverence. Though he is accustomed to use above all two forms of address for the cause, God and Lord, he has now taken up neither, but rather that of master, a term at once most reverent and most strictly proper. And yet these, Lord and master, are said to be synonyms. But even if the underlying reality is one and the same, the names differ in their conception. Lord is spoken from authority, kyros, which is a firm and settled thing, in opposition to what is unstable and without authority. Master, despots, is from bond, desmos, from which I think comes fear, so that the master is a lord, and, as it were, a lord to be feared, one who has not only authority and power fastened over all things, but is also capable of instilling awe and fear, and perhaps too because he is the bond of the universe, holding it together indissolubly and binding tight things that are of themselves dissoluble. The one, then, who says, Master, what will you give me? Is in effect saying this, I do not fail to know your surpassing power. I understand the fearsomeness of your dominion. In fear and trembling I approach you, and yet again I take courage. For you yourself have decreed that I should not be afraid. yourself gave me a tongue of instruction that I might know when it is necessary to speak. You yourself loosed my mouth that had been sewn shut. You yourself, having opened it further, gave it articulate speech. You yourself have put together the things that must be said, confirming that oracle. I will open your mouth and instruct you in what you are to say. Exodus 4:12. For it was you who ordained that I should not be afraid. It was you who gave me the tongue of instruction to know when I must speak. It was you who loosed my sewn shut mouth. It was you who, opening it further, gave it articulate speech. It was you who put together the very things I must say, confirming that oracle. I will open your mouth and I will instruct you in what you are to say. Exodus 4:12. For who was I, that you should give me a share of reason, that you should promise me a wage more perfect than any good of grace and gift? Am I not an exile from my homeland? Have I not been driven out from my kinship? Have I not been made a stranger to my father's house? Do not all call me a banished man and a fugitive, solitary and without honor. But you, Master, are my homeland to me, you are my kinship, you are my father's hearth, you are my honor, my freedom of speech, the great, celebrated, and unstealable wealth. Why then should I not be bold to say what I think? Why should I not ask, deeming myself worthy to learn something more? But I who say I am bold confess again that I am afraid and struck with terror, and the fear and the boldness in me do not wage an unmixed war, as someone might perhaps suppose, but rather form a blended harmony. So I feast insatiably on the mixture, which has persuaded me neither to speak freely without caution, nor to be cautious without freedom of speech. For I have learned to measure my own nothingness and to look all around at the surpassing heights of your benefactions. And whenever I perceive myself to be earth and ashes, and whatever is more contemptible still, then I take courage to approach you, having become humble, cast down into dust, reduced, as far as concerns my own substance, to the very verge of seeming not even to exist. And this passion of my soul, Moses, the overseer, inscribed as on a monument, in my own memorial. For he says, Abraham drew near and said, Now I have begun to speak to the Lord, though I am earth and ashes. Genesis 18:27, since that is the moment for a created thing to approach its maker, when it has come to know its own nothingness. And the words, What will you give me? Are the voice not of one at a loss, but rather of one giving thanks for the multitude and greatness of the good things he has enjoyed. What will you give me? For is there still something greater left to expect? Boundless, O lover of giving, are your graces, without limit, having neither boundary nor end, welling up like springs with more than is ever drawn from them. But it is worth considering not only the ever-flooding torrent of your benefactions, but also the fields that we irrigate with them. For if the stream should be poured out to excess, the plain, instead of fruit-bearing earth, will become a marsh and a swamp. What I need, then, for fruitfulness, is an inflow that is measured, not unmeasured. Therefore I will ask, What will you give me? Though you have given things beyond telling, and virtually everything that mortal nature was capable of containing. For what I still seek to learn and to acquire is this, who might become a worthy heir of your benefactions? Or shall I say, I shall depart childless. Genesis 15:2, having received a short-lived, ephemeral, swiftly perishing good when I pray for the opposite, one of many days, long-lasting, unspoiled, and immortal, so that it might be able both to cast seeds and to extend roots for the sake of firmness, and to raise its stock on high, lifting it up toward heaven. For human virtue must walk upon the earth but reach as far as heaven, so that there, feasted upon incorruption, it may remain forever unharmed. For I know that you, who bring into being what does not exist and beget all things, have hated a soul that is childless and barren, since you gave to the clear-sighted race the exceptional grace of never becoming barren or failing to bring forth. And I too, having been allotted a share in that race, rightly long to be its heir. For, beholding it to be unquenchable, I consider it most shameful to look on while my own nature is stripped of the good. I therefore become a suppliant and implore that out of the seeds and smoldering embers the saving light of virtue may be kindled and blaze up, a light which, handed on like a torch through successive generations, will become coextensive in time with the universe. You have given zeal also to those who practice the discipline, for children born and begotten of the soul, and, overcome by joy, they have burst out saying, The children with whom God has shown mercy to your servant, Genesis 33:5, children whose nurse and foster mother is innocence, whose souls are tender and well-formed, ready to receive the holy, beautiful, and most godlike stampings of virtue. But teach me this too, whether the son of Masech, my house-born servant, is fit to become heir of your graces, for up to now I have not received the one I hoped for, and the one I have received I do not hope for. Who Masech is, and who her son, must not be examined carelessly. Masech, then, is interpreted from a kiss. But a kiss differs from loving. For the one seems to show a union of souls fitted together by goodwill, while the other seems to display only a superficial and cold greeting brought about by some need that draws people together for the moment. For just as in looking up there is no stooping, nor is drinking down wholly the same as drinking, nor is a horse contained in a wallet, so too loving is not contained in kissing, since even among enemies countless people, yielding to the harsh necessities of life, extend a greeting. Who, then, is she who has been established with us from a kiss, but not from a genuine friendship? I will say it, holding nothing back. It is life together with sense perception, fortified in every way, which no one fails to love, whom the many consider a mistress, but the refined consider a handmaid, not a foreigner or a bought slave, but house-born and in a manner of the same stock. These latter have also been trained to kiss her, not to love her, while the former love her exceedingly and hold her to be thrice desired. But Laban, the hater of virtue, will not even be able to acknowledge the powers allotted to the one in training. Rather, having hung his whole life upon pretense and false fabrications, as though aggrieved, though not in truth pained, he says, I was not deemed worthy to kiss my children and my daughters. Genesis 31:28 CF. 28. And rightly and fittingly so, for we have been trained to hate irony. Love the virtues, then, and embrace them with your very soul and truly love them, and you will least of all wish to do that counterfeit of friendship, mere kissing. For do they still have a share or an inheritance in your house? Have they not been reckoned by you as strangers? Have you not sold them and devoured their silver? Genesis 31:14-15, so that not even afterward will you be able to give back what you have already devoured as ransom and redemption price. Pretend now that you wish to kiss them, you who are implacable toward every judgment. But Moses will not kiss a son-in-law in that fashion, rather he will love from a genuine passion of the soul. He kissed him, it says, and they embraced, Exodus 18:7. Now there is a threefold kind of life, one directed toward God, one toward becoming, and one in between, a mixture of both. The life directed toward God has not come down to us, nor come under the necessities of the body. The life directed toward becoming has never risen at all, nor sought to rise, but lurking in the recesses of Hades, delights in a life not worth living. But the mixed life is one which, often led by the better order, becomes divine and is possessed by God, but often, dragged back by the worse order, turns aside. This life, whenever, as on a scale, the portion belonging to the better life weighs down the whole, the counterweight of the opposite life, being dragged along with it, is rendered a most trifling burden. Moses, having crowned without contest the kind of life directed toward God, leads the remaining kinds forward for judgment, likening them to two women, of whom he calls the one loved and the other hated, fitting the names most aptly to each. For who does not welcome the pleasures and delights that come through the eyes? Who does not welcome those that come through the ears? Who does not welcome those that come through taste, smell, and touch? And who has not hated their opposites? Frugality, self-control, a stern and disciplined life empty of laughter and play, full of earnestness, cares, and toils, a friend of contemplation, an enemy of ignorance, superior to money and reputation and pleasures, yet inferior to prudence, good repute, and a wealth that sees rather than one that is blind. The offspring of the hated virtue are always the elder. But Moses, even though they are younger in time, judges these two by nature worthy of the elders' privilege, giving them a double share and taking away half from the others. For he says, if a man has two wives, one loved and one hated, and both bear him children, when he is about to distribute his property, he will not be permitted to give the elders' privilege to the son of the loved wife, of pleasure. For this son is young, even if he should become gray-haired with time. But to the son of the hated wife, of prudence, who from childhood is the elder, so as to assign him a double portion. Deuteronomy 21:15-17. But Rachel was barren. Gen 29:31. Is it not the case that whenever the soul begins to bear the offspring proper to soul, then whatever is perceptible to the senses, itself becoming barren, ceases to bear? Things which receive only the welcome given by a kiss, not the welcome that comes through genuine friendship. Of this life according to sense perception, then, which he calls Masic, each of us is a son, honoring and admiring the nurse and foster mother of the mortal race, sense perception, which the earthly mind too named Adam when he saw it fashioned as his own venomous death called life. For he says, Adam called his wife's name life because she is the mother of all the living, Gen 3:20, that is, of those who live, presumably, a life that is dead to the soul. But those who are truly alive have wisdom for their mother, and sense perception as a slave, fashioned by nature for the service of knowledge. The name of the one born from life, whom we came to know through the kiss, is composed as Damascus, which, translated, means blood of a sack, very forcefully and aptly hinting, by sack, at the body, and by blood, at the life of the blood. For since soul is spoken of in two senses, the whole soul, and its ruling part, which properly speaking is the soul of the soul, just as with the eye there is both the whole orb and the most sovereign part by which we see, the lawgiver held that the substance of soul is likewise twofold, blood for the whole and divine spirit for the most sovereign ruling part. At any rate, he says outright, the soul of all flesh is blood, Lev 17:11. How well he assigns the flowing of blood to the mass of flesh, kindred to kindred. But the substance of the mind he made dependent on nothing created. Rather, he brought it in as something breathed by God. For the Maker, he says, breathed into his face the breath of life that comes from the God of all things, and man became a living soul, Gen 2:7, by which also, according to the image of the Maker, reason is said to have been stamped, so that there are two kinds of human beings. The one living by divine spirit and reason, the other living by blood and the pleasure of the flesh. This latter kind is a thing molded from earth. That former is a faithful impression, bearing the likeness of the divine image. Our clay, molded with no small care and kneaded through with blood, stands in great need of help from God. Wherefore this one is called Damascus Eliezer. Translated, Eliezer means God is helper. Since the blooded mass, being in itself dissoluble and dead, holds together and is kindled to life by the providence of God, who stretches out his hand and shields it, since our race by itself could not remain firmly established for a single day. Do you not see that the second of Moses' sons bears this very name? For the name of the second, he says, carries with it its own reason. For the God of my father is my helper, and he delivered me from the hand of Pharaoh, Exod 18:4. And upon those who are still companions of the blooded, sense-perceptible life, there falls that formidable way of life whose business is to scatter piety, named Pharaoh, whose dominion, full of lawlessness and cruelty. It is impossible to escape without Eliezer being born within the soul, and without one's placing hope in the help that comes from God, the only Savior. And it was altogether fitting that he traced the descent of Damascus, not from a father but from a mother, Masic, in order to teach that the blooded soul, by which even the irrational animals live, belongs to the maternal, female kind, and has no share in male generation. But virtue is not Sarah in that sense, for she lays claim to descent from men alone, being a motherless origin, born from the father of all things alone, for he says, she is my sister, on my father's side, but not on my mother's, Gen 20:12. What it was necessary to hear beforehand, then, we have now set forth, for the proposition contained an enigmatic obscurity. But what the lover of learning is seeking must now be interpreted more precisely. Is it not perhaps this, whether it is possible for one who still desires the blooded life and still lays claim to things of sense perception to become an heir of the bodiless and divine things? Of these things only he is deemed worthy who has been breathed upon from above and has obtained a portion of heavenly and divine allotment, the purest mind, one who takes no account not only of the body but even of the other part of the soul, which, being irrational, is smeared with blood, kindling boiling tempers and inflamed desires. At any rate, he inquires in this fashion. Since you have not given me that intelligible seed, the self-taught, the God-formed, will my house-born slave be my heir? Gen 15:3, the offspring of the blooded life. Then God, hastening, arrived even before the venom could speak, having sent ahead, so to speak, instruction preceding the utterance. For immediately, he says, the voice of God came, saying, this one shall not be your heir, Jen. 15:4, none of those who come forward for display to sense perception, for it is bodiless natures that are heirs of intelligible things. It has been observed with the utmost precision that he did not say he said, or he spoke. But the voice of God came, of one crying out vigorously and resounding unbrokenly, so that the voice, distributed into every soul, might leave no part deserted and empty of right instruction, but that all things throughout might be filled with sound learning. Who then shall be the heir? Not the reasoning that remains by its own deliberate choice within the prison of the body, but the reasoning that has been loosed from its bonds and set free, and has gone forth beyond the walls and has left behind, if one may put it so, its very self. For he who shall come forth from you, this one shall be your heir, Gen 15:4. If then any longing enters the soul to inherit the divine goods, do not leave behind only your land, the body, and your kindred, sense perception, and your father's house. Gen 12:1, speech. But flee also from yourself and step outside yourself, like those possessed and driven into corybantic frenzy, seized by Bacchic and God-born inspiration under some prophetic rapture. For when the mind is filled with God and is no longer in itself, but is roused and driven to distraction by a heavenly love, and is led by him who truly is and drawn up toward him, with truth going before it and clearing away the obstacles in its path, so that it may walk along the highway of the road, this is the inheritance. How then did you migrate from those former things? Speak to us boldly, O mind, you who resound to those trained to hear things intelligible, ever declaring that I removed myself from the body, when already I disregarded the flesh. And from sense perception, when I came to regard all sensible things as mere appearances, not truly existing, having condemned its criteria as adulterated and bribed and infected with false opinion, and having condemned also the things judged by it, as things equipped to entice and deceive and snatch truth away from the very midst of nature. And I migrated also from speech, when I condemned its great irrationality, for all its soaring and self-inflation. For it dared no small daring, to show me bodies through shadows and realities through mere words, things which were impossible. Yet, though it stumbled, it babbled on and ran in circles, unable, through the mere commonness of names, to represent with clear distinctness the particular properties of the things underlying them. But having suffered this, like a foolish and infant child, I learned how much better it truly was to withdraw from all these things, and to dedicate the powers of each to God, who gives the body its bodily form and holds it together, and equips sense perception to perceive, and furnishes speech with the power to speak. In just the way, then, that you have withdrawn from the others, withdraw also and migrate from yourself. And what does this mean? Do not keep for yourself, as your own private store, the acts of understanding and thinking and comprehending. Rather, take these two and dedicate them to the cause of understanding with precision and of comprehending without being deceived. The dedication will be received by the more sacred of the two most holy precincts, for there appear to be two, the one intelligible, the other sensible. Of sensible natures, this cosmos is the temple, but of invisible things, the truly intelligible cosmos is the shrine of all the gods. That by stepping outside our own faculties of understanding and longing to be a follower of God, he becomes heir of a wealth that the nature of things itself sings of, he testifies when he says, he brought him outside and said, look up to heaven, Gen 15:5, since that is the treasury of divine things, for the Lord will open to you, it says, his treasury, the heaven, Deut. 28:12, from which the giver pours out, without pause, the most perfect joys. And look up serves also to expose the blindness of the common herd of men, who suppose they see, but are in fact maimed. How could they not be maimed, when they have chosen evils instead of goods, disgraceful things instead of noble ones, unjust things instead of just, passions instead of good feeling, mortal things instead of immortal, and when they run from those who would admonish and correct them, from reproof and instruction, but welcome flatterers and speeches aimed at pleasure, craftsmen of idleness, ignorance, and self-indulgence. The virtuous person alone truly sees, which is why the ancients called the prophets seers, 1 Sam 9:9, and the one who advanced outside was called not merely one who sees, but one who sees God, Israel, that is, one who sees God. But the others, even when they do open their eyes, bow toward the earth, pursuing earthly things and keeping company with the dwellers in Hades. For the one drinks in his vision toward the upper air and the circuits of heaven, and has been trained to fix his sight on the manna, the divine word, the imperishable food of the soul that loves contemplation, while the others look to onions and garlic, which sting the eyes and harm them and make them shut tight, and to the other foul smells of leeks and dead fish, the native foods of Egypt. "We remember," they say, "the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, and the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our soul is dried up, our eyes see nothing but the manna," Num 11:5-6. It also bears on character formation that he brought him outside, words that some, out of a tasteless disposition, are accustomed to laugh at, saying, "Is a person led inside, or does he conversely enter outside?" Yes, I would say, you ridiculous and altogether too flippant men. You have not learned to track the ways of the soul, but investigate only the movements of bodies from place to place. That is why it seems paradoxical to you that anyone should go out inward or come in outward. But to us who are disciples of Moses, none of this is discordant. Would you not say that the high priest who has not yet attained perfection, when he performs the ancestral rites of his fathers in the innermost sanctuary, is both within and without, within in his visible body, but without in his soul, which wanders and roams? While conversely, someone who does not even belong to the priestly family, but is a lover of God and beloved by God, though he stands outside the sprinkling vessels, dwells in the innermost place, regarding his whole bodily life as an exile abroad, and supposing that whenever he is able to live by the soul alone, he remains in his homeland. For indeed every fool is outside the door, even if he spends every day with others and is never absent from them for a moment, and every wise man is within, even if he happens to be settled apart, not merely in different lands but in the far quarters of the earth. According to Moses, the friend is so near that he makes no difference from one's own soul, for he says, "The friend, who is as your own soul," Deut. 13:6. And of the priest too it is said, "No man shall be with him when he enters the Holy of Holies, until he comes out," Lev. 16:17, not in the bodily sense, but with respect to the soul's affairs. For the mind, when it serves God in purity, is no longer human but divine, but when it turns to something merely human, it has come down from heaven, or rather it has fallen to earth and gone outside, even while the body still remains within it. Rightly then is it said, "He brought him outside," outside the prison houses of the body, the dens of the senses, the sophistries of deceitful reasoning, and beyond all these outside of himself and outside the illusion of thinking and grasping things by his own independent and self-governing judgment. Having led him forward outside, it says, "Look up to heaven and count the stars if you can number them, so shall your offspring be," Gen 15:5. It is beautifully said, "shall be," not merely equal in number to the stars. For God means to signify not that one thing alone, but countless other things bearing on complete and perfect happiness. "So shall it be," he says, like the visible heavenly realm, ethereal, heavenly, full of unshadowed and pure radiance, for night is banished from heaven, and darkness from the upper air, most star-filled, well-ordered, governed by an unswerving order that remains constant and unchanging. For he means to show the soul of the wise man as an imitation of heaven, or, to put it even more boldly, as an earthly heaven, containing within itself, as if in the upper air, pure natures, movements, harmonious dances, divine circuits, the most starlike and radiant brightnesses of the virtues. And if it is impossible to find the number of the visible stars, how much more impossible is it to find the number of the intelligible ones? For to the degree, I think, that the judging faculty is better or worse than the thing judged, mind being better than sense perception being duller than understanding, to that same degree, the things judged also differ, so that intelligible things surpass sensible things by an immeasurable multitude. For the eyes of the body are the smallest fraction of the eye of the soul. The one is like the sun, while these practice only kindling and going out, like lamps in their sockets. It is therefore necessary that it goes on to say, "Abraham believed God," Gen 15:6, in praise of the one who believed. And yet, someone might perhaps ask, "Do you judge this worthy of praise? who would not pay heed to God when he speaks and makes a promise, even if he happened to be the most unjust and impious of all men. To such a person we shall say, Noble sir, do not thoughtlessly strip the wise man of the praise that is his due, nor bear false witness against the most perfect of the virtues, faith, by crediting it to unworthy men, nor accuse our understanding of these matters of error. For if you were willing to make a deeper inquiry, and not a wholly superficial one, you would clearly recognize that it is no easy thing to believe in God alone, apart from anything else, because of our kinship with the mortal nature to which we are yoked. A kinship that persuades us to place our trust instead in wealth, reputation, office, friends, health, and bodily strength, and in many other things besides. But to wash oneself clean of every one of these, and to distrust created being, which of itself is wholly untrustworthy, and to trust in God alone, who alone is truly trustworthy, is the work of a great and Olympian understanding, one no longer enticed by anything among the things that belong to us. It is well said, too, that his faith was reckoned to him as righteousness. Gen 15:6. For nothing is so just as to make use of unmixed and unadulterated faith in God alone. This, though just and consistent with nature, has been thought paradoxical because of the general faithlessness of the many, whom the sacred word rebukes by declaring that to be moored firmly and unswervingly to being alone is a marvel among men, for whom the possession of unmixed goods does not exist, but is no marvel in the sight of truth, which awards the prize. It is simply the work of righteousness alone. He said to him, it says, I am the God who brought you out of the land of the Chaldeans so as to give you this land. Gen 15:7. This signifies not merely a new promise, but the confirmation of an old one. The good bestowed long ago was the exodus from the astrology of the Chaldeans, which taught one to suppose that the world was not God's work, but God himself, and that good and ill for all existing things are apportioned by the movements and fixed circuits of the stars, and that from these, the origin of good and evil depends. Beliefs which the smooth and orderly motion of the heavenly bodies persuaded the more credulous to elaborate into marvels. And indeed the very name Chaldeans, translated, is akin in meaning to smoothness, while the new good was to inherit wisdom, which sense perception cannot receive but which is grasped by the purest mind alone, through which the best of migrations is confirmed, as the soul changes its home from astronomy to the study of nature, from unstable conjecture to firm apprehension, and to put it properly, from the created to the uncreated, from the world to its maker and father. For those whose minds are Chaldean-minded have put their trust in heaven, but the one who has migrated from there has put his trust, the oracles say, in him who is above heaven and charioteer of the whole universe, God. A fine inheritance indeed, perhaps greater than the capacity of the one who receives it, yet worthy of the greatness of the one who gives it. But it is not enough for the lover of wisdom to hope for good things and to look forward to such wonders as are foretold by the oracles, unless he also comes to know the manner by which he will attain succession to the inheritance. He considers himself no better off, thirsting as he is for knowledge and insatiable for it. That is why he asks, saying, Master, by what shall I know that I shall inherit? Gen 15:8. Perhaps someone might say this conflicts with having believed, for to be perplexed belongs to one who doubts, but to no longer seek is the mark of one who has believed. It must be said, then, that he both is perplexed and has believed, yet not about the same thing, far from it. For he has believed that he will be heir of wisdom, but seeks only the manner in which this might come about. That it will come about he has grasped with complete certainty, in accordance with the divine promises. The teacher, then, having praised the longing with which he pursues learning, begins his instruction from an elementary introduction, in which the first and most necessary thing written is take for me, Gen 15:9. The expression is brief, but it signifies much, for it reveals no small matters. First, he says, you possess nothing good of your own, but whatever you suppose you have, another has supplied it. From this it is gathered that all possessions belong to God who gives, and not to created being, which is a beggar stretching out its hands to receive. Second, even if you receive, receive it not for yourself, but consider what is given a loan or a deposit belonging to the one who deposited and lent it, repaying an earlier favor with a later one, justly and fittingly requiting the favor that came first with the gratitude that answers it. for countless people have become deniers of sacred deposits, misusing what belongs to another as their own through boundless greed. But you, noble friend, strive with all your strength not only to keep unharmed and unadulterated what you have received, but also to deem it worthy of every care, so that the one who made the deposit may have no charge to bring against your keeping of it. The maker of living things deposited with you soul, reason, and sense perception, things named symbolically in the sacred writings as heifer, ram, and goat, Gen 15. 9. Some appropriated these at once out of self-love, while others stored them up for the most opportune moment of repayment. Of those who misappropriate them, one cannot find the number. For which of us does not say that soul and sense perception and reason, all these together, are his own possessions, supposing that perceiving, speaking, and comprehending rest on himself alone? But of those who genuinely preserve their trust as sacred and truly inviolable, the number is small. These have dedicated these three things to God, soul, sense perception, reason, for they received them not for themselves, but for him, all of them, so that they rightly confess that the activities of each belong to him. The thoughts of the mind, the interpretations of reason, the impressions of sense perception. Those, then, who inscribe these things to themselves have obtained a lot worthy of their own wretchedness. A soul treacherous, mixed up with irrational passions and overtaken by a multitude of vices, at one time outraged by gluttony and lust as though in a brothel, at another confined by a multitude of wrongdoings as though in a prison together with criminals, not people, but practices, which have become liable to every judge. A reason glib-mouthed, sharpened against truth, harmful to those who meet it, bringing shame to those who possess it, and a sense perception insatiable, always gorging itself on sensible things, yet being under the mastery of unrestrained desire, never able to be filled, paying no heed to those who would correct it, so as to overlook and mishear and spit out whatever is spoken for its benefit. But those who received these things not for themselves, but dedicated each of them to God himself, kept them truly holy and sacred for their owner, the mind, so that it should think of nothing else but God and his virtues. Reason, so that with unbridled mouth it might honor the Father of all with praises and hymns and proclamations of blessedness, mustering all the virtues that serve interpretation for this one work alone and displaying them. And sense perception, so that, forming images of the whole perceptible world, heaven and earth and the natures between them, living things and plants, their activities and powers, and all their motions and states, it might report these to the soul without deceit and impurity. For God has granted to the mind to apprehend the intelligible world through itself, and the visible world through sense perception. If then, one could live with every part of oneself for God rather than for oneself, peering through the senses into sensible things for the sake of discovering truth, and through the soul pursuing philosophy concerning the intelligible things that truly are, and through the instrument that produces voice, hymning both the world and its craftsmen, then one will enjoy a happy and blessed life. I think these things are implied in Take For Me. Wishing, moreover, to send down from heaven to earth an image of divine virtue, out of pity for our race, so that it might not miss its share in the better lot, he constructs, symbolically, the sacred tabernacle and the things within it, a likeness and imitation of wisdom. For the oracle says that the tabernacle was set up in the midst of our uncleanness, so that we might have something by which to be purified, washing and cleansing away the things that defile our wretched life, so full of ill repute. Let us then see in what manner he ordered the materials contributing to its construction to be brought in. The Lord spoke, he says, to Moses, saying, to the sons of Israel, and take for me first fruits from all whose heart inclines them, you shall take my first fruits. Exod 25, 1-2. Here too, then, is an exhortation to take not for themselves, but for God, examining who the giver is and not damaging what has been given, but keeping it unharmed, blameless, complete, and whole. And he dedicated the beginnings to him in the most doctrinally significant way. For in truth, the beginnings both of bodies and of affairs are examined only in relation to God. Search, if you wish to know, into each thing, plants, animals, arts, sciences. Are then the first seed sowings of plants works of farming, or are they the invisible works of invisible nature? And what of the origins of humans and other animals? Do they not have their parents as contributing causes, but nature as the highest, most venerable, and truly the cause? For arts and sciences, is not nature the spring and root and foundation, and whatever other name of a more venerable origin there may be, on which all the particular theorems of each are built up? And if nature does not exist beforehand as a foundation, all things are incomplete. From this, it seems to me, someone was moved to say, the beginning is half of the whole, hinting at nature as the beginning, which, like a root, is laid down for the growth of each thing, and to which he assigned half of the whole. Rightly, then, has the oracle dedicated beginnings to God the guide. And elsewhere too, it says, the Lord spoke to Moses, consecrate to me every firstborn, first produced, that opens every womb among the sons of Israel, from man to beast. It is mine, Exod 13, 1-2. So that it is agreed also through these words that things belong to God both in time and in power, and especially the firstborn. For since every kind is imperishable, it will rightly be assigned to the imperishable one. And if one is to speak of opening a womb altogether, from man, that is reasoning and reason, to beast, that is sense perception and body. For the one who opens the womb of each thing, of the mind for its intelligible apprehensions, of reason for its activities through speech, of the senses for the impressions that arise in them from underlying objects, of the body for its own proper states and motions, is the invisible, seed-bearing, and skillful divine word, which will fittingly be dedicated to the Father. Moreover, just as beginnings belong to God, so also do ends. Moses bears witness to this, commanding that the end be set apart and acknowledged to the Lord, Num 31, 28ff. The things in the world also bear witness. How so? The beginning of a plant is seed, its end is fruit. Each is a work not of farming but of nature. Again, the beginning of a science is nature, as has been shown, but its limit has never yet come to human beings. For no one is complete in any pursuit, but completeness and the heights of perfection belong, without deceit, to one alone. We, then, are carried along for the rest in the borderland between end and beginning, learning, teaching, farming, laboring at each of the other pursuits as though sweating, so that whatever comes to be may seem to accomplish something. More clearly, however, he confessed that beginnings and ends belong to God when speaking of the coming to be of the world. In the beginning God made, Gen 1:1, and again, God completed the heaven and the earth, cf. Gen 2:1-2. For the present, then, he says, take for me, Exod 25:2, giving what is his own and urging that what has been given not be adulterated, but kept in a manner worthy of the giver. While again elsewhere, he who needs nothing, and for this reason takes nothing, will not admit to taking anything, but does so for the sake of anointing us toward piety and instilling eagerness for holiness and sharpening our own service to him, as one who welcomes and receives the soul's willing acts of goodwill and genuine service. For he says, behold, I have taken the Levites instead of every firstborn that opens the womb from the sons of Israel. They shall be their ransom. Num 3:12. So we take, yet we are said to give, properly speaking we take, but by an extension of usage we are said to give, for the reasons I have stated. And fittingly, he named the Levites ransoms. For nothing so releases the mind into freedom as becoming a suppliant and refugee of God. This is what the consecrated tribe of the Levites professes. Having, then, said what is fitting concerning these matters, let us run back to our starting point. For we passed over many things that ought to have been treated with precision. Take for me, he says, a heifer unyoked and unharmed, tender, young, and vigorous, a soul able readily to receive the reins, discipline, and oversight. Take for me a ram, reason, a perfect contender, able both to dissect and refute the sophistries of adversaries, and able also to secure safety together with good order for the one who uses it. Take for me also the darting sense perception directed at the world of the senses, a goat, holy 3 years old, having its consummation in the perfect number, the middle term, and besides these, a turtle dove and a pigeon, Gen 15:9, that is, divine wisdom and human wisdom, both winged, and both trained to leap upward, yet differing from one another as a genus differs from a species, or an archetype from its imitation. For divine wisdom loves solitude, because of the one God whose possession it is and cherishes being alone, this is symbolically called the turtle dove, while the other kind is tame, domesticated, and gregarious, circling the cities of men and taking pleasure in a way of life shared with mortals. The pigeon is likened to this latter kind. It is these virtues, I think, that Moses is hinting at when he names the Hebrew midwives Shifra and Pua, Exod 1, 15. The one is interpreted as little bird, and Pua as red. It is proper to divine knowledge, like a bird, always to soar aloft. It is proper to human knowledge to instill modesty and self-control, of which blushing at what deserves it is the clearest evidence. And he took for himself all these things, Gen 15, 10. This is praise of the one who, having received the sacred deposit entrusted to him, soul, sense perception, reason, divine wisdom, human knowledge, kept it purely and without deceit, not for himself, but only for the one who had entrusted it. Then he adds, he divided them in the middle, without adding who did it, so that you may understand it is the God who cannot be pointed to who fits and unites, by the word that is the divider of all things, all the natures of bodies and of affairs that seem to follow one upon another in sequence. A word wedded to the sharpest edge, which never ceases dividing. For all sensible things, when this divider has proceeded as far as the atoms and so-called indivisible parts, then in turn begins from these to divide the objects of reason into portions countless and undelinable. And the leaves of gold are cut into hairs. Exod 36:10, as Moses says, cut so fine as to resemble incorporeal lines. So he divided each of the three in the middle, the soul into the rational and the irrational, reason into the true and the false, and sense perception into apprehensive impression and non-apprehensive. These divisions he immediately set facing one another, irrational against rational, true against false, apprehensible against inapprehensible, but he left the birds undivided, Gen 15:10, for it is impossible to cut incorporeal and divine things into warring opposites. This is a long and necessary line of argument concerning division into equal parts and concerning opposites, and while we will not pass over it, neither will we draw it out, but abridging it as it deserves, we shall content ourselves with only the essential points. For just as the craftsman divided our soul and our limbs down the middle, so too he divided the substance of the universe when he was fashioning the world. Taking it in hand, he began to divide as follows. First, he made two sections, the heavy and the light, separating the coarse textured from the fine textured. Then he divided each of these again, the fine textured into air and fire, the coarse textured into water and earth, which he laid down as the perceptible elements of the perceptible world, like foundations. Again, he cut the heavy and the light by other distinctions. The light into cold and hot, he named the cold air, and the hot, by nature, fire, and the heavy in turn into moist and dry. He called the dry earth and the moist water. Each of these in turn admitted further divisions. Earth was divided into continents and islands, water into sea and rivers and whatever is drinkable, air into the turnings of summer and winter, and fire into the destructive kind, which is insatiable and corrupting, and, by contrast, the preserving kind, which was allotted to the constitution of heaven. And just as he divided the wholes, so he divided the parts, some of which were inanimate and some animate. And of the inanimate, some remain in the same state, held together by cohesion, while others move not by change of place but by growth, which unseen nature has endowed with life. And of these, some bear the wild produce of wild matter, which serves as food for beasts, while others bear the produce of cultivated matter, whose oversight and care has fallen to farming, and which brings forth fruits for the enjoyment of the gentlest of all living things, man. And just as he divided the inanimate things, so he divided the things that have a share of soul. Among these, he distinguished one kind irrational, one kind rational, and taking each in turn, he divided it further, the irrational into the untamed kind and the domesticated kind, and the rational into the imperishable and the mortal. And of the mortal, he made two portions, naming the one male and the other female. And in another way, too, he divided the living creature into male and female. And it admitted still other necessary divisions, which distinguished the winged from the land-dwelling from the water-dwelling, and the water-dwelling from both of the other extremes. In this way, God, having wedded the Word that is the divider of all things which is His own, divided the shapeless and qualityless substance of the universe, and the four elements of the world separated out from it, and the animals and plants in turn formed by means of these. Since He says not only, He divided, but also, He divided them in the middle, it is necessary to recall a few points about equal divisions as well. For what is divided exactly down the middle produces equal portions. Now, no human being could ever divide anything into perfectly equal parts, but of necessity, one of the portions must fall short or exceed the other, and if not by a large amount, at least by some small part, one that perhaps escapes the perception of those whose senses, by nature and by habit, engage only with the coarser masses, and are unable to grasp what is atomic and indivisible. Of equality, no created thing is found, by an incorruptible account of the truth, to be the cause. It appears, then, that God alone is exactly just, and that He alone is able to divide bodies and affairs down the middle, in such a way that none of the portions, not even by the smallest and most indivisible fraction, becomes greater or less than the other, but is able to share in the highest and most perfect equality. Now, if the equal had but a single form, what has been said would suffice. But since there are several, we must not shrink from adding what is fitting. For equality is spoken of, in one sense, in numbers, as 2 is equal to 2 and 3 to 3 and so on. In another sense, in magnitudes, which have length, breadth, and depth as their dimensions. For a handbreadth is equal to a handbreadth and a cubit to a cubit in size. But there are other things equal in power, as in weights and measures. There is also a necessary form of equality that operates by proportion, according to which the few are reckoned equal to the many, and the small to the great. And cities are accustomed to use this kind at critical times, requiring each citizen to contribute the equal share of his substance. Not, of course, in number, but in proportion to the assessed value of his estate, so that the man who contributes 100 drachmas would seem to have given the same as the man who contributes a talent. With these points laid down beforehand, see how, in dividing down the middle, He divided into equal parts according to every form of equality, in the generation of the whole heaven. In number, then, He divided the heavy things equal to the light. 2 to 2, earth and water, which have weight, against air and fire, which are light by nature. And again 1 to 1, the driest to the moistest, earth to water, and the coldest to the hottest, fire to air. And in the same way darkness to light, day to night, winter to summer, autumn to spring, and all things akin to these. In magnitude, He made equal in heaven the parallel circles, the equinoctial circles, the spring and autumn ones, and the tropical circles, the summer and winter ones. And on earth the zones, 2 equal to one another, which lie near the poles and are frozen and for that reason uninhabited, and 2 which border both these and the scorched zone, which are said to be inhabited because of their temperate climate, the one lying toward the south, the other toward the north. Equal 2 in length are the intervals of time, the longest day to the longest night, and again the shortest to the shortest, and the middling to the middling. The equinoxes seem best to disclose the equal magnitudes of the other days and nights as well. For from the spring equinox to the summer solstice, the day gains and the night loses, until the longest day and the shortest night are brought about. And from the summer solstice the sun, turning back on the same path, neither faster nor slower, but keeping to the same and like intervals, moving with equal speeds, comes round to the autumn equinox, and having made the day equal to the night, begins to increase the night and diminish the day until the winter solstice. And when it has made the night longest and the day shortest, turning back again along the same intervals, it arrives at the spring equinox. Thus the intervals of time, which seem unequal, achieve equality in magnitude not within the same seasons of the year, but across different ones. And when it brings about the longest night and the shortest day, and then again, turning back through the same intervals, arrives at the spring equinox. In this way, the intervals of time, though they appear unequal, exchange their equality of magnitude, not within the same seasons of the year, but across different ones. The same thing may be observed too in the parts of living creatures, and especially of human beings. For foot corresponds to foot, and hand to hand, and almost everything else is equal in size, the parts on the right to those on the left. And things equal in capacity are extremely numerous both among dry things and moist things, and the assessment of these is made by measures and scales and similar means. By analogy, indeed, virtually all things are equal, both the small and the great, throughout the whole cosmos. For those who have examined the workings of nature, most exactly say that the four elements are equal by analogy, and that the whole cosmos too, having been blended by analogy, was constituted by allotting an equal share to each part, and having been so constituted persists forever in this condition. And indeed the four elements affecting us, dry, moist, cold, and hot, have been fitted together by blending an equality achieved through analogy, and we ourselves are nothing other than a mixture of these four powers blended in an equality of analogy. If one went through each case in turn, one could in principle extend the account to infinite length. For one would find the smallest living creatures equal by analogy to the greatest, the swallow to the eagle, the red mullet to the sea monster, the ant to the elephant. Indeed, body and soul and passions, pains and pleasures, and further affinities and aversions, and whatever else the nature of living creatures embraces, are almost all alike in kind, made equal by the rule of analogy. In this way, some have been bold enough to declare that even the smallest living creature, man, is equal to the whole cosmos, having observed that each of the two consists of a body and a rational soul. So that, interchanging the terms, they said that man is a small cosmos, and the cosmos a great man. And they do not teach this at random, but because they recognize that the art of God, by which he fashioned the universe, admits neither intensification nor relaxation, but remaining ever the same in its consummate excellence, has fashioned each of the things that exist to perfection, God having made use, in his creating, of every number and every form conducive to perfection. For according to the small and according to the great, as Moses says, he judged Deut. 1:17, and in shaping each thing he neither, on account of the obscurity of the matter, withheld anything of his skill, nor, on account of its brilliance, added anything beyond what was fitting. Since even those craftsmen who are held in esteem, whatever materials they take in hand, whether costly or of the humblest kind, wish to work them in a manner deserving of praise. And indeed some, out of special devotion to beauty, have produced in the cheaper materials work more skillful than that in the costly ones, wishing by the addition of their knowledge to make up for what was lacking in the material. But nothing in matter is precious in the sight of God. Therefore, he imparted the same art equally to all things. Hence, too, it is said in the sacred writings, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Gen 1:31. And things that share in the same excellence are, in the judgment of the one who praises them, altogether equal in honor. But God praised not the matter that had been fashioned, the lifeless, flawed, dissoluble matter, in itself corruptible, uneven, and unequal, but his own works of skill, each brought to completion by one equal and uniform power, and by a knowledge that is alike and the same in every case. For this reason it was held that, by the standards of analogy, all things are equal and alike to all, in keeping with the principle of his art and knowledge. And if anyone else has ever been a praiser of equality, Moses has been, first by hymning, always and everywhere, justice as well, whose peculiar property, as its very name somewhere shows, is to divide bodies and affairs into equal portions, and then by censuring injustice, the artisan of that most hateful thing, inequality. Inequality gave birth to the twin wars, the foreign and the civil, just as, conversely, equality gave birth to peace. And his praises of justice and his censures of injustice he sets forth most vividly when he says, "You shall do no injustice in judgment, in measures, in weights, in scales. You shall have just scales and just weights and just measures and a just quart measure." Lev 19:35-36, and again in the supplementary law, "There shall not be in your bag two weights, a large and a small. There shall not be in your house two measures, a large and a small. A true and just weight shall you have, that you may live long upon the land that the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, because everyone who does these things, everyone who does what is unjust, is an abomination to the Lord." Deut 25:13-16. God then, who loves justice, abominates and hates injustice, the origin of faction and of evils. And where does the lawgiver not embrace equality as the nurse of justice, beginning from the very creation of the whole heaven? "God," he says, separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day and the darkness night. Gen 1, 4-5. For it was equality that assigned to the things that exist their day and their night, their light and their darkness. Equality also divided the human being into man and woman, two portions unequal in strength, but with a view to that toward which nature was hastening, the generation of a third thing resembling them both, equal in the highest degree. For he says, God made man, according to the image of God he made him, male and female he made, no longer him, but them, he adds, in the plural Gen 1:27, fitting the species, once divided by kind into equality, as I have said. Cold too, and heat and summer, and spring he recorded, Gen 8:22, the yearly seasons again divided by that same divider. And indeed the 3 days before the sun came into being were equal in number to those after the sun, Gen 1, 5ff. The six being honored with equality so as to signify eternity and time, for the 3 days before the sun he assigned to eternity, and those after the sun to time, which is an image of eternity. As for the primary powers of the existent, the beneficent power, by which he formed the cosmos, which is called God, and the punitive power, by which he rules and governs what has come to be, which is called Lord, he says that these are set apart by him as he stands above in the middle. For I will speak to you, he says, from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, Exod. 25:21, in order to show that the most venerable powers of the existent, the bestowing power and the punitive power, are equal, using him as their common divider. What then? Are not the tablets of the 10 general laws, which he calls the tables, two in number, equal to the parts of the soul, the rational and the irrational, which need to be instructed and disciplined, divided again by the lawgiver alone? For the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, engraved upon the tables, Exod. 32:16. And indeed of the 10 words upon them, which are properly the ordinances, an equal division has been made into 2 sets of 5, of which the first contains the just claims owed to God, and the other those owed to human beings. Of the just claims owed to God, the first ordinance is the one opposed to the belief in many gods, teaching that the cosmos has but a single ruler. The second is the one concerning not fashioning gods out of things that are not causes, by the conniving arts of painters and sculptors, arts from which Moses banished, as their own peculiar exile, all those who practice them from his commonwealth, casting his vote against them, so that the one God alone, and in truth, might be honored.